translation. The city called Arpana represents engagement of the tongue in speech, and Bahudana is the variety of foodstuffs. The right ear is called the gate of Pitrihu, and the left ear is called the gate of Devahu. As there's no purport, I'll read subsequent verses, or at least one, maybe more. Pravritam cha nivritam cha shastram panchala sangitam pitriyanam devayanam shrotraj shruta darad vrajet. Narada Muni continued, the city spoken of as Dakshina Panchala represents the scriptures meant for directing pravriti, the process of sense enjoyment in fruitive activities. The other city, named Uttara Panchala, represents the scriptures meant for decreasing fruitive activities and increasing knowledge. The living entity receives different kinds of knowledge by means of two ears, and some living entities are promoted to Pitriloka and some to Devaloka. This is made possible by the two ears. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The Vedas are known as Shruti, and the knowledge received from them through oral reception is called Shruti Dhara. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, one can be promoted to the planets of the demigods, or to the planets of the Pitas, the forefathers, or even to the Vaikuntha planets, simply through the process of hearing. These things have already been explained in previous chapters. Omagyana timaranda siddhinandana shalakaya chakshurun militang jaina tasmai shi guru veri namaha vanchakalpaturubhis cha kripasindhivyavacha pititanam pavanibhyo vaishnavibhyo namo namaha shi krishna chaitanya prabhu nityananda shi advaita gadadhar shi vasati gaura bhaktavinoda hare krishna 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 hari 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 ram 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 hari hari This part of the Bhagavad Purana includes a lot of what is called Sankhya Yoga. Sankhya means to count or to analyze. It's one of the six darshans. Darshan has different meanings. Generally when we come, primarily two, generally when we come before the deity, to take audience. The English word is audience, although the word audience refers to the ear, and darshan refers to the eyes. Still, the meaning of audience is quite close to darshan. Sometimes you take audience of a special person or a great personality. So similarly, we come and take darshan of either the deity or the guru. It's called the darshan. So there are six darshans in the Vedic tradition. Sometimes they're called different schools of thought. But they're not exactly different schools of thought. Because the word darshan also means perspective. In other words, they're perspectives, different perspectives on the same truth. Just different ways of looking at the same truth. That's an interesting way of looking at it. Regrettably, when it comes to issues of spirituality, or specifically religion, we sometimes get the feeling that we're talking about different objects of knowledge or different gods. I did have the experience once of walking through Watford, which is near, some of you may know, it's near Bhaktivedanta Manor. In England, and I was passed by one Muslim gentleman. I could tell by his dress, and he shouted, what did he shout? Allah is my God, or something similar to that. I was a little peeved. Afterwards, it reminded me of those who support a particular religious, football team, somehow or other. That seemed to be the kind of, the mood of it. It was rather like, because the British are not well known to be good football supporters. They're very often violent. And unfortunately, the same mood is sometimes there with so-called religious people. Experience, but the point to understand from the word darshan is that actually we're actually looking at the same truth. Truth is one. Of course, there's a lot of debate about this in society. Oh, I'm sorry, I beg your pardon. Oh, they're in the kitchen listening to me. Okay. That makes me feel better. At least I know someone's cooking. Truth is one. Of course, there are lots of debates about this, is whether truth is one. I mean, the common misconception these days, at least in my opinion, is a misconception. I think also in the opinion of Shastra, or scripture would be a misconception, is that everyone's truth is okay for them. You have your truth, I have my truth. And that's called relativism. There are many debates about this in society, about relativism, which is an extreme position. But of course, on the other tradition, there's the kind of idea there's only one truth, and regrettably, it usually seems to be my truth. There's the truth, and there's a non-reflective approach to truth, and a non-accommodation of others. Mm-hmm. So we reject. And these debates are very prevalent, of course. If you look at, for example, what's going on in France in response to the threat of terrorism and concern about the Muslim tradition, you'll find perhaps quite a slightly different approach than in the UK. But of course, the British have always had a slightly more liberal approach to philosophy than the continent. There's historical things there. But there are very serious issues here about plurality and singularity of truth. Generally, here with the idea of darshan, the idea is that it is an interesting one because it tends to resolve these debates. How does it resolve these debates? And what is that debate again? One debate is we have different perceptions, they're all valid on one side. And the other is there's only one truth and everyone must follow it and that's it. It tends to resolve these tensions by saying there is one truth. And yet, we all perceive that truth differently. Mm-hmm. So there are different perceptions on that truth. And we recognize that actually we do have those different perceptions on the same truth. Mm-hmm. Darshan, that idea of darshan. And of course, within our own tradition, it's interesting. Here, there's a lot of emphasis given to Shruti, Shastra. Because they're considered the primary, at least in our tradition, or in the Vedantic tradition, that's one of the six darshans. In the six darshans, there are different authorities accepted. Some accept two pramanas, sources of evidence. Some accept three, some accept four. I think there's a total of 10 different pramanas, authorities. In Vedanta, in our tradition, we know what those are, I'm sure all of us know, but to remind you, they're Anuman, Pratyaksha, and... what's the third one? Shabda, yeah. So pratyaksha means the senses. Anuman means the mind. Deduction, what we work out, usually using the information that comes through our senses. And then shabda means... actually sound. Yeah, it's relevant here. It refers to shastra. It refers to scripture, but it also, literally, it means sound. Why does it mean sound? Because in the Vedic tradition, then it's an oral tradition. It's heard. Actually, I was writing one book on Hinduism recently, and that had to be edited. And I wrote, actually, the Hindu tradition was originally passed down, or the Vedic tradition, as we like to call it, was originally passed down orally, and later was written down and is now transmitted like that. But the scholar made a comment, there are still parts of the tradition where they actually dispute the validity of writing down knowledge. They still say that knowledge should be transmitted orally. Interesting. So there are three types of pramana or evidence we accept. Sometimes, at least within ISKCON, we tend to discount anumana pratyaksha completely and give emphasis to only to shabda. But actually there are all sources of evidence, and actually it's interesting to look at how do we get knowledge. Here it's mentioned. Of course, there's another important point I'm going to make here, is that actually by hearing, there's two ears mentioned here. One is meant for receiving, I think it's the left ear. And Tattvavit Prabhu, am I right in saying that? The left ear is for material knowledge and the right ear is for spiritual knowledge. It might be mentioned here. It's a little bit implicit. I think it's the right ear. Or is it the other way around? It's the left ear for spiritual knowledge. Okay, I got it wrong. My right ear seems to be stronger, obviously, materialist. We may think this to be mere superstition, or some nice religious sentiment, but actually if you start to analyse, especially the Sankhya philosophy, it's very, very deep and very analytical, and the different ears, I think as we mentioned a few days ago, are related to different planets. One is feminine, one is masculine, one is the sun, one is the moon. Same for the eyes. There's a great science, actually, of how the body is constructed and some of the subtle understandings of the body. It's a great science. And therefore religion, at least in the Vedic tradition, in our tradition, is a science. It's a means of education. Rajavidya, Rajaguyam, Pavitram, Idam Uttamam, Pratiksavagumam, Damyam, Shushukam, Kartamavyayam. It's Rajavidya. Vidya means knowledge. Regrettably in the West, sorry, this is getting a little philosophical, but anyway, in the West very often science and religion are separated. It is seen that actually knowledge is the domain of science. And religion is for faith. And there's quite a rigid division. Regrettably, that division we can blame on the Germans. And particularly one German, Immanuel Kant, who actually did make a very strong distinction between the two. And he actually said that he was very perceptive in many ways, of course. He was a great philosopher. And he actually recognized that actually our knowledge is mediated through our mind and senses, our physical apparatus. And therefore he concluded that actually because the mind and senses are limited, it can never extend to what he called the noumenal or the spiritual. Not bad. But actually, there's somewhat of it, and he actually said there's a division there, there's a border beyond which we can't pass. We can know things about this world through the senses, through the mind, but we can't know about the noumenal. We can know about the phenomenal, but not the noumenal. However, there's a slightly different approach within our own tradition, and that is that border can be changed. It's flexible. And therefore, by certain practices, and this is particularly evident in the darshan called yoga, which is actually the sister darshan of Sankhya. Sankhya is the philosophical concept, the conceptual model behind the practice of yoga. Because each of the darshans, there's three sisters, one tends to be the philosophical matter, the kind of more jnana aspect, and the other tends to be more to do with the practice or the karma. So Sankhya and Yoga actually are paired up as one pair of sisters, as it were. So by yoga particularly, and by other disciplines, one actually starts to extend the boundaries of knowledge. In the West, generally, anything that's to do with direct experience of the, say, of God, is considered miraculous or extraordinary or exotic or magical, and so on. Whereas actually within our tradition, it's generally accepted that those experiences are quite normal in a sense. Why? Because there isn't such that rigid division between the material and the spiritual. And by almost as if one, like playing a musical instrument, one can fine-tune it. One can also fine-tune the body and the senses and the mind to actually push back those boundaries of knowledge, to actually get glimpses of the spiritual realm. It's also interesting that anything to do with the supernatural is a little bit, we feel a little bit uncomfortable, generally speaking, I'm generalizing here, not always, but in the Western, I mean, looking a little bit at the difference between worldviews, because there is somewhat of a prevalent Eastern worldview and a prevalent Western worldview. It's a generalization. But we tend to be rather uneasy with anything to do with the supernatural. Mm-hmm. Whether we come from the religious tradition, which tends to invoke generally quite a bit of fear of the supernatural, or we come from empiricism, which is extremely skeptical about the existence of anything. Well, therefore, if you look in the West, generally sciences such as astrology tend to be considered a little bit wacky. And of course, many of the astrologers are a little bit wacky. But you'll find within India still some of the Brahmins. The Brahmins were actually considered the best of the... the astrologers were considered the best of the Brahmins, at least the Karmakandya section. The astrological texts were written by Parashara Muni, who's the father of Vyasadeva, the author of the school called Vedanta. Each school has one particular scholar who's the founder of that school or the advocate for that school. So Vyasadeva wrote the Vedanta Shastra. Very great, respectable authority. So Parashara Muni was the author of many of the astrological... It's a great science, again. Why? It's connected to some of the concepts discussed here, how the self is embodied in this city of the body, and how it's embodied because of the law of karma, action and reaction. So these are the three types, three authorities in Vedanta, and the process is to actually get knowledge through the Vedas. It's interesting, the word Veda has two main meanings again. One, it refers to a specific body of texts which are generally considered to be of Indian origin. But Veda literally means knowledge. In other words, there is a connotation that it refers to knowledge that is common to us all, coming back to this theme. It's not that knowledge is an exclusive thing. Actually, knowledge is common to us all. Therefore, we find, if we're in Belgium, we could probably understand some of the common knowledge or proverbs, let's say, that come from England or India. Because we have what we would probably term at least a shared humanity. Knowledge is the same. We understand the same things. So that knowledge is common to us, really. Real wisdom is another word we might use. And here is explained how we get that wisdom. We get it from the Shastra. Because our own mind and senses will mislead us. Who has experience of being misled by the mind and the senses? There's all kinds of stories we could tell. Some quite palatable, some not so palatable. Jai Shishi Radha Gokula. Of how we can be illusioned by the senses. Some of you may know I have a twin brother, and he looks just like me because we're identical. But we always have a joke with the sannyasis in our movement when we're together, that we're able to illusion even the sannyasis. but we can always be misled by thinking one thing is something else. One person is another person, or whatever. I mean, anyway, we're all subject to that kind of illusion through the senses. And the mind also can concoct wrong ideas. Sometimes we think something about a person. We have an impression of a person. Somehow, when we get to know them, we realize, I got that wrong. So the mind and senses certainly mislead us. Shruti is considered here the highest form of knowledge. But does that mean that we simply literally follow scripture, whatever it is, and ignore anuman and pratyaksha? No, that will not work. We have experience of literalists, and sometimes it's the literalists who tend to become very exclusive and don't understand the commonality we all have and the commonality of knowledge. Therefore, it's useful for us to start to engage with the mind and senses. And to the system we have in the Vaishnava tradition, Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition, is to purify the mind and senses. So they have to gradually be purified by a particular lifestyle. And also we need to actually start to test. Are we seeing correctly? And eventually one becomes what is called Shastra Chakshus. Seeing through the eyes of Shastra, of scripture. But that doesn't mean we just are able to quote verses. It's going to mean after a while that the way we see is actually consistent with what is in Shastra. And interestingly, as we mentioned a few days ago, knowledge is described in the Bhagavad Gita, and the knowledge that's in goodness, rather than influenced by passion and ignorance. You may also know that these three gunas come from the Sankhya school of philosophy, though they've been assimilated into Vedanta. They're a Sankhya concept, the three gunas. First, there's goodness, the best, which is illuminating. It gives tranquility and serenity. It's based on knowledge. Seeing, it's actually, knowledge, goodness is seeing things as they are. When one is in goodness, one sees things as they are. Passion means ambition, desire, contact of the senses as described here with the sense objects, the ears with beautiful sound, for example. That is passion. We think that's the standard of happiness. And then ignorance means darkness. It's that that's born out of ignorance, laziness, intoxication, madness, desire to get away from it all and sleep and Oh yes, as devotees we have our own ways of getting into ignorance, I know. We may not be able to eat meat, but we have our own ways of getting into ignorance. Because when passion is frustrated, it leads to ignorance. We can understand these three modes. And you actually see when a person is in ignorance, probably typified someone who's an alcoholic or a drug addict, hopeless. You're almost finished. Very hard to get out of that. Very difficult. It's hopelessness. And therefore, Adanta Govia, Tamishram, driven by the senses, one goes. Tamishram means to hell. That means you enter the lower species, other species of life, and no knowledge is there. We're going to come to that, controlling the mind and the senses. But this is the tamas. So actually, these three called gunas are there. Goodness, sometimes it's symbolized by yellow, the color yellow. Red, passion symbolized by red. Yeah, isn't it? Red's a passionate color. Mars. Dark blue, kind of reminds us of the weather in Rai Dadesh. Kind of heavy, overcast, depressed. Yeah. What's the knowledge in those three modes? In goodness, we see the same living entity in all living beings. Same. The body is different to the self. Therefore, we don't differentiate between humans and animals. This is not good. And there's a lot of talk now about animal rights as well as human rights. Why not? The animals feel there's consciousness there. This is goodness. Passion, we differentiate between animals and humans, between different... We're aware there's some kind of consciousness, some life force in there. We have that consciousness. We're aware of it. But we differentiate between the different beings within the body. And then in ignorance, there's no empathy whatsoever. Don't even realize there's a soul in the body. Of a human being even. No empathy for others, and therefore criminals and so on tend to have this lack of empathy. He showed no emotion when the sentence was read out. So knowledge, this is real knowledge. And it begins with this point. It doesn't begin with God, generally in the Vedic tradition. That is something which is quite, in a way, quite distant from most of us. It begins with the self. Who are we? If we can just understand this one point, that we are not this body, then we're starting our spiritual life. But we tend to be misled, and the first type of misidentification, or the first illusion we make, being misled by the mind and senses, is to think, I am this body. This is me. And immediately you've got problems, because immediately I'm white and you're black. I'm old and you're young. I'm a man and you're simply a woman. I'm a human being and you're just an animal. I was living in Oxford, you just lived in Belgium. Immediately. All these, and look at all the problems in the world. And everyone's trying to address them. Is Barack Obama white or is he black? Regrettably, we can't get off that platform. And even when we're trying to oppose those problems, we're still thinking in terms of black and white. But Albert Einstein said, a notable proverb of saying, we cannot solve the problem keeping the same mindset that created that problem. We have to change our way of seeing. That is knowledge here. It's not mere information. It's about changing the way we see the world, and therefore we have to start as devotees, through the process of purification, beginning to see the world accurately. Therefore, we have to also take note of our mind and senses. Don't try to just ignore them. It won't work. They won't go away. We have to deal with them very much. These are some of the perhaps lessons we could hear. Particularly, we need to hear from Shastra. And that hearing is important, but there are other stages as well in the hearing process. Particularly reflecting on what we've learned and applying what we've learned and so on. That is the process of actually beginning to assimilate that knowledge. And of course, knowledge is practical. Here it's mentioned, you can go to the Pitriloka or the Devaloka or even to Vaikuntaloka. Knowledge is not something that you learn. Hence there's a problem sometimes with learning pure theology. What are we going to do with it? Teach others to learn theology. In Oxford, that's generally what you do. You learn philosophy and you teach someone else philosophy. But that's not the standard of knowledge. It's not a purely academic subject. It must be relevant. And therefore, when we're learning from the Srimad Bhagavatam, we should think, what can we learn from this? And I'm wondering now, what have we learned? But I think it's important for us as devotees to try and apply this knowledge. And also, how do we actually deal with our mind and senses? We can't ignore them. We have to begin to purify them. I was going to speak on a verse, two verses later, on controlling the mind. And one thought I had was actually, we sometimes have to begin to learn to trust our intuition. We may be skeptical about the mind and what it says, and that's good. But also we should learn to trust that intuition, because sometimes it's right. And if we take to spiritual life, if we have a moral lifestyle, something will begin to tell us, this is right, this is wrong. We have to listen to that very, very careful, and enhance that voice. So that's probably something we can learn. Any questions or any comments, please? Another Jai Bhadra. When it's purified, it's the super soul, you're right. Yeah, therefore human beings have intuition. Otherwise animals are controlled by instinct. Actually, the super soul is instinct in animals. In human beings, it's conscience. Therefore, we have to begin to listen to that conscience. We have it. We have moral choices as human beings. Animals don't.
The intuition is very difficult in the moment to discern from the plain mind and the bad mind. It's very difficult. When you have the shastras, maybe afterwards you can say, oh yes, it was a Paramatma who led me. If the thing runs good, but if the thing runs bad and you are taking drugs at the ending of your intuition, of getting in a better consciousness, you are lost.
Absolutely.
And you can be lost forever. Because if you are in drugs,
you can't be lost forever, because the soul always comes back. There's no eternal damnation. But one can be lost for a long time, because after all, if you go into that situation, you will not take a human birth next, because your consciousness isn't like it. You're right, it's very hard to differentiate between, you know, what is the conscious, what is conscience and what is the mind. And therefore one has to seek guidance from Shastra, from Guru, from wise people, keep the right company. However, I think the point I was making, one, we have to use some guidance even in the beginning, because we have decisions to make in life. You know, we can't have the Guru with us to tell us which shoelace to tie up first, or whatever. And we do have decisions to make all the time. We have, you know, decisions. So even from the beginning, we have to use that. And secondly, we should try and purify that, because after it's invaluable to have that. Because when the spiritual master passes away, as he will or she will, you know, we have to then take guidance. And we may still have Shastra and Sadhus, but you know, and we'll find ourselves in situations when there is nothing. There's simply myself. How do I act now? I mean, personally, if I was to make note of all the dilemmas, minor dilemmas, I go through each day, I'd probably have 10, 20 or 30 each day. Little dilemmas. I do. I wasn't feeling very well this morning, so do I go to sleep or do I carry on my japa? If I take sleep, my intelligence will be stronger. But if I chant my more japa, maybe I'll be sharper. I mean, there's all the time. I mean, that's one big challenge I have, is how much, you know, in the morning, if I'm very tired, how much to take rest. This is practical. We experience it because we get up early. We have our ideal, but there are these dilemmas.
Isn't it your mind and instinct will tell you which would be the right thing to do that moment?
Your mind and... Well, instinct we don't
the
have...
Rest of Japan.
I don't like the word instinct. It's used a lot in professional circles generally. I mean, I think probably we mean intuition would be more the word.
Intuition.
Yes, you can have intuition, but of course... And we should use it, and we'll have different degrees of it. But also sometimes what we think is our intuition is sometimes wrong. And therefore a certain degree of skepticism should be there. And all of us have made decisions based on our own... Sometimes we think it's our intuition, and we go, that didn't work out, did it? You see, so therefore, until one comes to the level of purity, one's intuition is always subject to maya or illusion. But you're right, we should try and develop that intuition, actually. We shouldn't ignore it. And I know in our own organization there has sometimes been a tendency to say, to deal with the mind and just ignore it, don't listen to it at all. But the point is, we do engage with the mind, and we need to actually have that dialogue with the mind. And we need to make friends with the mind and control the mind. It's, there's a, There's a whole science to this, actually, and we could go on. Any final question that we should finish?
You were talking about mind and senses and how do we meet the world of the soul. I heard a lecture from Subhata Maharaj a few days ago, and he also talked about this topic. And he says that the same point that you mentioned, that people see the world according to their mind.
Yeah.
So it's just like projecting. And yeah. When he gets the answer, he says, seeing the world as it is actually seeing this whole universe. Seeing Krishna and his energy, that's the only reality. And if we don't see this whole world as Krishna, only Krishna and his energy, so we're seeing Maya. And if we see everything as Krishna and his energy, so that's the truth.
Yeah, that's one way. That's one way of seeing the world. That everything's related to Krishna.
That's the only reality one he says.
Yeah. That's considered to be the reality. There is a spiritual reality. That spiritual reality generally begins with understanding the self, because that's accessible. Can't really get away from the self, can we? Sometimes we won't want to, other times we're good company. But true, there is also a supreme self, and therefore we can meditate on how that supreme self is connected to this world. Yeah, there is only, and therefore in the Bhagavad Gita, when we see the sun, we think, ah, that's Krishna. We see the moon, we go on holiday, we see the ocean. this is Krishna. That's one. So it's a matter of purifying and seeing things as they are. Good point. Let's finish there. Gives us something to think about for the day. Let's try and meditate on this a little bit and see if we can, by thinking and our intuition, see if we can get more realizations on this and apply this. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.